Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa. For years, Parcast has worked tirelessly to bring you an unprecedented look at history's most radical true crime events. Your support has not only allowed us to keep exploring these stories, but has driven us to keep expanding as well. So as a thank you to the Parcast listeners, I am honored to announce the release of our first book, Cults: Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Joined Them. It's available on July 12th, and you can pre-order it today at parcast.com/cults. The Branch Davidians, the Anthill Kids, Heaven's Gate, and more. Cults combs through the terrifying details never explored in any of Parcast's series before. This is a passion project only made possible by you. So we truly hope you'll enjoy it. Visit parcast.com/cults to pre-order your copy of Cults: Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Joined Them. Please be advised that this episode contains names and representations of Indigenous Australians. This episode includes depictions of graphic violence, cannibalism, and child abuse. Listener discretion is advised, especially for listeners under 13. Please note, the story you're about to hear is not a direct retelling of any one story of the Pankarlongu. Today's episode combines features from a number of Aboriginal Australian legends for dramatic effect. Hello, everyone. I'm Vanessa Richardson, and welcome to Mythical Monsters, a Spotify original from Parcast. Each week, we travel the world in search of the most epic creatures from myth and legend, exploring who they are, where they come from, and what they say about the culture they terrorized. You can find all episodes of Mythical Monsters and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. Today, we head to inland Australia, once again to introduce you to a different kind of desert-dwelling cannibal. Unlike the salt flat-loving Ngaiyur Nongalku, they do not need to hide below the earth, and they always work alone. The Pankarlongu kill everything they meet, whether it's rodents, lizards, or other Pankarlongu. But their favorite delicacy is human children. People say they like to decapitate toddlers and hang the heads from their belts, beating an eerie rhythm as they walk back to their camps, ready to roast and eat their newest victims. Coming up, we see what happens when you get too close to this hairy giant. In some ways, the Pankarlongu is a culmination of all the Aboriginal monsters we've examined this past month. Like the Bunyip, their danger is specifically tied to their setting. Like the Ngaiyur Nongalku of Kumpapintle, or Lake Disappointment, they're cannibals. And like the Yarmayahu, their favorite food is children. But they don't hide below the salt flats or beneath the water in the billabongs. They stride across the Tanami Desert of North Central Australia, seeing no reason to hide or lie in wait. Instead, their prey comes to them. If Indigenous infants and toddlers get too far away from camp, they're quickly snatched up by these murderous, hairy giants. The Pankarlongu use the same hunting techniques their human neighbors use when hunting lizards. They lift the child up in the air and hit their head against the ground. The Pankarlongu then carries the corpse back to their cook fire, where they roast and dismember it. It's said that you can still find the remnants of these grisly camps while crossing the arid landscape. Most legends and reported sightings of the Pankarlongu come from the Warlpiri people, an Aboriginal Australian group known for their music, dance, and language, which can be communicated verbally or through signing. The Warlpiri have carved out an existence in the Tanami Desert for millennia. And if you ask them, the Pankarlongu have too. The boy had been in the world for 13 summers. He remembered 9 of them. The rest were shrouded in that strange haze of early childhood, where thoughts and sensations become one sizzling wash of experience. The boy lived with his father in the desert, where the red sand scalded your feet if you walked when the sun was shining. He was always amazed that it didn't bother his father, whose skin was as leathery as the belt around his waist. His father was tall, so tall that the boy's head barely reached that same belt. His father assured him that he would grow someday too, but the boy had a feeling his father was humoring him. There were some things that separated the boy and his father, not just their physical differences, but what father allowed him to do. For instance, his father was a great hunter, but he never taught the boy how to kill and barely even let him watch the hunt. The only time the boy got close was when father captured lizards. He would grab them, quick as a snake, and bash them against the ground. He shook and slammed them until they went still. Then they roasted them whole over the campfire. The boy offered to help, of course. He was growing now, and he wanted to contribute. But his father always told him the world was too big, and the boy was too small. Perhaps when he was older, hairier. For the moment, he only needed to be a child. So the boy sat in their shaded camp, hiding from the high noon sun, waiting for his father to return with food. Roast leg was his favorite. His father would drag home the bodies of men that were his size or sometimes larger. He'd skin them slowly, bit by bit, until the raw, red meat was exposed, setting their hairy hides aside for later. He served the loin on blackened skewers, sprinkled with seeds and sweetened with fig juice. The boy was always so glad that each man had two legs to give. His father at least let him help with the cooking. There were many ways to be a Pankarlongu, he always said. That was what his father called himself, a Pankarlongu. The men he killed were Pankarlongu too, but the boy had never seen another child Pankarlongu before. When asked why, his father just shook his head solemnly. It seemed like a sore subject, so the boy avoided it. All in all, the boy liked his life and loved his father. He was only eager to grow, to help, to be more like a Pankarlongu so his father wouldn't have to work so hard. The Pankarlongu had no need for wells. He knew where the water holes were. Deep red rocks hid them from the world. He would often escort the boy to these oases and leave him on the bank before venturing out to hunt. It was in this soft, safe place that the boy met Japal Jari. Japal Jari looked to be the boy's age, maybe a little younger. He stumbled out of the desert, lips chapped and skin burnt. He was small and almost hairless, with wide features and deep brown eyes. The boy's heart leapt. This person looked just like him, another Pankarlongu child at last. The boy waved at the newcomer. The other boy's eyes widened in shock, and he warily introduced himself, like he too had never seen someone like himself. The boy could not contain his curiosity.
"Very nice to meet you, Japal Jari. What are you doing here?"
Japal Jari stared at him.
"What are you doing here? This is not your country. Who are your people?"
The boy was confused. This was his country, the Pankarlongu's country. He told Japal Jari so, and the other boy's jaw dropped.
"That monster? But you're like me, you're a..."
The boy's father seemed to come from nowhere. He grabbed Japal Jari by the leg, arcing him up into the air and back onto the ground with a sickening crunch. The boy stood frozen in shock. Bile rose in his throat. His father had struck Japal Jari like a lizard. The other boy was dying, maybe dead. And any answers he had were dying with him. Coming up, the boy learns the truth. Listeners, I have a very special announcement. Parcast is releasing its first book on July 12th, and you can help us celebrate. It's called Cults: Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Joined Them. And you can pre-order it today at parcast.com/cults. This book was written for the fans, so to commemorate its launch, Parcast will be throwing some exclusive in-person and online events featuring popular true crime hosts such as Ashley Flowers from Crime Junkie, Christine and M from And That's Why We Drink, and more. Just visit parcast.com/cults for event dates, locations, and how to sign up. See your favorite true crime authors and podcasters discuss the cults book and have a chance to participate in live Q&As. These events have limited space, so don't miss out. RSVP today. None of this would be possible without your support, so we truly hope you'll join us. Pre-order your copy of Cults and sign up for upcoming events at parcast.com/cults. Now, back to the story. The boy had a name, but he did not remember it. He did not remember the campfire he toddled away from or the people he left behind. It was, after all, 10 years ago when he was so very young. Long before the violence he had just witnessed, long before his supposed father, the Pankarlongu, attacked the kid who looked like him. The boy paled as his father dragged Japaljari along the ground, preparing for another hit. He slammed the stranger into the sand. Japaljari let out a groan. A wave of nausea rose in the young Pankarlongu's throat. He had known that this was how his father did his work. He had no qualms about that. Yet seeing it like this, done to a child, it was too much. The boy ran forward as the Pankarlongu pulled on Japaljari's leg again, signing as quickly as he could, "Wait, wait, father!" He stood between them, placing his small hand on top of the Pankarlongu's large one. The Pankarlongu looked down at his son, unsure.
"Get out of the way, boy. He will make good eating."
The boy studied Japaljari as he spoke to his father.
"He looks like me."
The Pankarlongu looked pained.
"He is not you. Now get out of the way."
Japaljari groaned again, his mouth full of wet sand. The boy gently pushed on his father's arm.
"Please spare him. There is still much to eat."
The Pankarlongu looked down at the ground, struggling to decide. Finally, he tossed Japaljari into the dirt. Japaljari screamed in pain, then went silent. The Pankarlongu stomped off towards the waterhole. He untied his belt, dropping it to the sand without a word. Then he walked straight in up to his nose, his long hair floating in the still water as he faced away from them. The boy was left looking at his father's discarded belt. Heads hung from it, mummified by the desert wind and sun. The boy realized suddenly that their small faces had once looked like his. Was this why his father hadn't made him a belt of his own? The boy studied his father's back, still mostly submerged on the other side of the pool. He lowered his voice and asked where the boy came from. Japaljari laughed bitterly. He spat up blood and a few teeth.
"Like I said, Japaljari, it's where you come from too, I'll bet, judging by your face. You're my missing brother, aren't you? The boy who never came home."
The boy pulled back. That didn't make sense. He had a father. He had a country. But the other boy was so certain.
"What do you mean? What proof do you have?"
Japaljari's smile was stretched to its breaking point, his eyes mirthless.
"Aside from your face?"
He gestured vaguely at the pool.
"Look at yourself. I've got no reason to lie. I know I'm going to die here. You're going to eat me. We would have looked for you, tried to save you, but we all thought you'd be hanging from his belt long ago."
The boy's father called to him from the water. He gave Japaljari one last look, then waded into the pool. He walked slowly, studying the ripples of tension in the Pankarlongu's back. The Pankarlongu's voice was softer than the boy had ever heard it.
"Why did you stop me?"
The boy paused, then repeated,
"He said I am his brother. Why would he say this?"
The Pankarlongu didn't respond right away. He did not meet the boy's eyes. The boy was about to ask again when his father began to speak, or rather to sign. This was too complex for words alone, and too difficult. It was the story of how the two of them had met, and such stories were always more complicated than they first appeared. It was 10 seasons ago. The boy had stumbled away from his family's campfire, too curious for his own good. There, he had encountered Pankarlongu. Unafraid, he'd asked for the name of this tall stranger. The Pankarlongu stood silently, his dark eyes reflecting the far-off flames of the campfire the boy had left behind. It was customary to introduce yourself by your skin name, similar to a family name. The boy had said,
"I'm Chapel Jari."
Then he tried again.
"Who are you?"
Hearing this story aloud, the boy flinched. Chapel Jari, the same family name his so-called brother used to introduce himself. The Pankarlongu hadn't answered the little boy's questions. Instead, he'd stepped towards the child. There was a strange slap and rattling. The boy had tried to see where it was coming from, but the night covered them like cold, dark water. The boy leaned forward. How else was he to see him better? The Pankarlongu took another step. The rattling increased with every movement. The boy thought they were beads at first, small black beads suspended from a thin leather belt that went around the man's furry stomach. Then he studied them more closely. They were in tight pairs of two. Eyes. They were eyes. Glassy eyes in small, brown faces. Heads like his were hanging from this hairy man's waist. Small, flat noses and swollen lips sat below the still eyes, twisted in surprise and agony. The boy did not remember this. He did not remember discovering that the Pankarlongu wasn't answering him because he did not speak the Chapel Jari language. He had believed his father taught him to talk this way, this blend of speaking and sign tailored to broad, hairy hands. But he had taught his father. The boy had forgotten. It was better this way. The past was past, so the Pankarlongu said. If the boy had been raised with his people, he would have known that he was in the dreaming, where the past was not the past and the future was now. He hadn't expected these secrets to return to him. He hadn't even known to look for them. Until Chapel Jari, a boy who might have been his reflection, stumbled into his camp. And his father tried to kill him. His father had no apology. Only a question. "What do you want to do with him?" The boy swallowed, still reeling, unsure how to feel. But his father would not wait. He knew that all too well now.
"He says he's going to die. I'd like for him not to, sir."
He'd meant the word as a sign of respect, but he could feel the Pankarlongu tensing again, his fuzzy cheeks twitching ever so slightly. "You have a decision to make, my son." The Pankarlongu signed slowly, deliberately. "Where he comes from, where you come from, your name is a bond. He is your brother. The men who miss him will be your kin. They will do you no harm. But if we free him, he will return to them, and they will find this place. They will come to kill me. I will not let that happen. There will be at least one death tonight, maybe more. You will decide if it will be one Chapel Jari or two." Coming up, the boy makes a dangerous decision. Now, back to the story. The boy struggled to remember the world before it was only him and his father. He knew it was 10 years ago or thereabouts. He'd been old enough to walk, but not old enough to know where he was going, or to run away from monsters when they take you by the hand. His father had confessed to taking him, but hadn't he wanted to go?
He'd wandered into the dark, he remembered that much, and his father had taken care of him, fed him, raised him, and in his own Pankarlangu way, he'd loved him. Now, his father was forcing him to decide who he cared about, his own family or Japal Jari, a boy who resembled him so closely they could have been brothers, who was his brother, if what he was claiming was true. The boy had never contemplated the idea that he might be anything other than a Pankarlangu. He admired his father more than speech could convey. He'd been more than willing to help him kill others like them, other Pankarlangu. He hadn't realized that he wasn't like them at all.
"I don't want to leave you."
The Pankarlangu's face didn't move as he signed, "Then we kill the Japal Jari." The boy pleaded.
"He won't tell anyone about us, I'm sure of it. He'll just be grateful to live."
His father shook his head. "You don't know him, son. You don't know them. You have asked to join me in killing. Now is the time."
The boy nodded before he could stop himself. The thought of losing his only family was too painful for him. He couldn't sacrifice his father for some idea of a family he'd never met. The Pankarlangu led the boy out of the water. They both stood over Japal Jari. He was passed out, sweating, his face pale. The boy told himself this would be a mercy. His father held out a sharp rock.
"You will need this. You are not strong enough yet."
The strangest thought ran through the boy's mind, a distant memory of bashing lizards against stones, being proud of himself. This was just like that, wasn't it?
Japal Jari shuddered in his sleep. The boy raised the rock.
Something was growing in his chest, squeezing his heart tighter and tighter, bit by bit. He adjusted his grip on the weapon. He'd planned for this. He'd wanted this. It represented being a man, being like his father, being proud of who he was and where he'd come from. But where he'd come from had been a lie. He scraped at the dregs of his childhood memories, trying to picture a parent, a playmate, a village before he'd lived in the desert. He saw nothing. Maybe it was the boy who was lying, and his father was ashamed of him for believing it. Maybe it could all be fixed if he could just kill Japal Jari and eat him. That was what he wanted, wasn't it? He'd always wanted his father to let him join in the hunt. He could be a true Pankarlangu, no matter what he looked like, no matter that he wasn't tall enough or hairy enough. All the boy had to do was kill his brother. He raised the rock overhead, and he dropped it. He couldn't do it. The boy couldn't bring himself to look at his father. He knew he'd failed. The Pankarlangu stood still for a very, very long time. The boy waited for the blow to come, waited for his father to grab him by the ankles and smash him against the rocks. If he wasn't Pankarlangu, he was their prey, no different from the bloody body at his feet. Then the Pankarlangu spoke.
"Yundamu is 6 hours' walk east. Fill up on water before you go."
Then he walked back into the water, swimming all the way to the other end of the pool. The boy wanted to protest, but something silenced him, maybe guilt. He filled his water skin and lifted Japal Jari onto his shoulders. He wished one more time that they were as broad and furry as his father's. Then he left the waterhole behind. It was hard to travel by himself. His father had always led the way with such certainty and strength. Now the boy struggled to track the motion of the sun as it set. He needed to head away from it, east. His father had said east. The sun fell and the moon rose, covering the red sand with shadows. The boy had to check repeatedly if Japal Jari was breathing. An owl hooted at him as he stumbled through the brush. The boy knew he could not stop. If he stopped, he would never move again. It took many more hours than six, and his lips were cracked and stinging by the time he got there. But he used his last burst of energy to run forward as the village came into view, lit by the golden sunrise. Yundamu was like no place he had ever seen. Lean-tos of wood and brush clustered around a central campfire with room to dance and talk and eat. He'd never seen so many people at one time. As he approached them, they stopped what they were doing and blinked.
"What has happened? Who is this?"
He answered,
"Jabal Jari."
And in an instant, they all knew. They rushed to their injured brother, their son, to heal him. But they also recognized their other son, one that had been lost and was now found. They brought him into the village. They sang and danced in celebration. They gave him the initiation rites to make him a man. The Jabal Jari boy was home again. He did feel at home, he did. The quarters were closer than he was used to, the food less succulent. But slowly, these things became normal to him. He lived as the rest of them did, with one small exception. Every time he saw a child waddling away from the village, he followed it to the edge. Then he watched it disappear into the sandy darkness. He didn't want his father to be lonely or hungry. The Pankarlongu is what's known in Aboriginal Australian tradition as a hairy man, a bestial and furry creature larger than any human. Their brows are heavy and their hair long. They're far stronger than any mortal man. But there's another creature that fits this description, a Neanderthal. It's possible that tales of the Pankarlongu come from encounters with these prehistoric cousins. It's thought by many that these accounts were then mixed with a general fear of strangers and the need to warn children away from the perils of the Tanami Desert to create a man-eating monster. The Neanderthal hypothesis gets even more interesting when you consider the Warlpiri legend that inspired today's story, the story of the Pankarlongu, his adopted son, and the son's safe return when he reaches the age of maturity. Here, the Warlpiri see an unexpected streak of kindness in the Pankarlongu. The story's end is happy, if a little bittersweet. You cannot trust a Pankarlongu to be merciful, it suggests, but if you lose someone to the desert, one may not need to give up hope. Sometimes even monsters surprise you. But, of course, the Pankarlongu remains a monster, a child-chomping, deadly desert threat. And the unique thing about Aboriginal Australian legend is that sometimes it doesn't feel like legend at all. The age of spirits and monsters is never over, so the threat remains real for those who believe. The Warlpiri have reported Pankarlongu sightings as recently as 2013. You never know what might walk out of the desert or how hungry it will be. Thanks for listening to Mythical Monsters. We'll be back next week with an all-new season, International Cryptids. And we're starting things off with one of the most iconic cryptids of all. You can find all episodes of Mythical Monsters and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. I'll see you next time. Mythical Monsters is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound designed by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, and Carly Madden. This episode of Mythical Monsters was written by Jen Riche, edited by Robert Teamstra and Nora Battelle, fact-checked by Bennett Logan, researched by Adriana Gomez, and produced by Freddie Beckley. I'm Vanessa Richardson.
Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa. Exciting news. Parcast's first book, Cults: Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Join Them, is now available for pre-order at parcast.com/cults. Thanks to your support, we've compiled years of research, insights, and a catalog of case studies to expose more about these cults and the people behind them than ever before. Details which haven't even been explored in our Cults podcast. Visit parcast.com/cults to pre-order your copy of Cults: Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Join Them.